Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Canada honors the men and women that served and died in the war in Afghanistan. The Prime Minister, the Governor General, and thousands of military members took part in the Day of Honor. We'll bring you full coverage of the tribute, and the President of the Royal Canadian Legion tells us why he had serious concerns about the event from the start.
This week, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau said he wants all future candidates of his party to vote pro-choice. We speak with some current Liberal MPs who are anti-abortion to get their reaction to the new rules.
We also take a look at the massive anti-abortion rally on Parliament Hill called March for Life. I speak with a member of the Campaign Life Coalition about an abortion pill that's under review by Health Canada.
A new twist in the battle between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Beverly McLaughlin. Reports say after McLaughlin raised concerns, the PMO asked Justice Marc Nadon to resign and join the Quebec Bar. We talked to former Justice Minister Erwin Kotler about this revelation, and McLean's political editor Paul Wells weighs in on the McLean's panel.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Friday, Canada paid tribute to the men and women who fought in the war in Afghanistan. More than 40,000 soldiers took part in the 12-year mission that formally ended just 6 weeks ago. The mission came with a cost, though, with 158 soldiers being killed while serving our country.
The Day of Honor on the Hill began with a memorial ceremony in the Senate chamber where dignitaries sat next to veterans and their families. A lone trumpeter played the haunting sound of the last post, which was followed by a moment of silence. After that service, the VIPs made their way outside where a Chinook helicopter, a Leopard tank, and other military vehicles were on display for the public.
The outdoor ceremony was complete with a flypast of military aircraft, a 21-gun salute, a parade of hundreds of soldiers, and the end of a relay where the last Canadian flag flown in the mission was handed over to the Governor General. The head of the Canadian military, Chief of Defense Staff Tom Lawson, gave his personal thanks to his soldiers that fought in this long and grueling campaign.
Ultimately, our efforts in Afghanistan can be seen as an evolved mission of unprecedented complexity and length. And while we knew that the last Canadian troops would come home one day, that day when our flag was lowered for the last time was long in coming. To all members of the Canadian Armed Forces, retired and active, thank you for your service. You have served with honor, you've served with distinction and devotion, and you've made Canada proud.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper also honored the hard work and sacrifice of those who served in the Afghan mission.
Our troops stood strong. Our country stood strongly behind them. This National Day of Honor, the first of its kind in Canadian history, is a unique opportunity for us to say thank you to the men and women who have fought and served for Canada. We are here today to honor their dedication, to honor their heroism, and to honor their sacrifice. We have gathered as a country, one country united in appreciation, to offer our gratitude. And we have also come together as Canadians to make a collective promise. It's the same promise our forebears made after the conflicts of their times. And it is simply this: we will remember.
Later in his speech, the Prime Minister announced the dates 2001 to 2014 will be chiseled into the National War Memorial to forever honor the Afghan mission.
Now, when the Prime Minister declared May 9th a National Day of Honor, he might have expected the Royal Canadian Legion to be an enthusiastic supporter of the idea. But the Legion ended up disgruntled.
Gordon Moore, the Legion's Dominion President, spoke to McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about his misgivings 2 days before the Friday ceremonies. Moore started out expressing his concern about the way the day was planned.
I am very disappointed in the government that, you know, the notice that we did get was the week of April the 7th. The first letter and the second letter was on the 10th of April from the Prime Minister's office. saying that they're going to be mailing these letters across the country to all the Royal Canadian Legion branches.
Mm-hmm.
If we had been notified back in January or right at the initial stages of planning, we could have made this, made the Honor Day something that everybody would have, you know, kept in the backs of their minds for years to come. But unfortunately, it was a very secretive program, and so this is what we can do.
Do you have any? Have you been given any explanation for why it was done in such a secretive way, and that the details came to you so late? Has anyone apologized or said to you, "Look, this is what happened, Gordon"?
No. No one has emailed us or called me on it, or even the letter expressing that. Not at all.
Given those well, it sounds like bizarre delay and secrecy surrounding it. How about the event itself? Are you comfortable with the way it's been organized, the sorts of ways that the Afghan service is being memorialized?
Well, you know, November the 11th is the day that we remember for all who paid the supreme sacrifice. The Royal Canadian Legion was built in 1926 by veterans, for veterans, and that still stands today. Whether you're 19 years of age or whether you're 105 and you paid that supreme sacrifice or you came home to your family, November the 11th is the day for remembrance for all. Having this day of Honor Day for our Afghan veterans, it's a day of closure for some. I know that there's some of the Afghan veterans and their families are not going to even watch anything on TV. They're not coming to Ottawa. They want nothing to do with it because of they're disappointed with the way the government has treated them and the lack of respect, communication, and not getting the benefits that they need.
Mm-hmm.
It's very across the country. The other thing, too, is the government has opened up a whole new can of worms here by recognizing the Afghan vets, and some Bosnia vets have stepped forward, and so have some Gulf War veterans, showing, you know, expressing their disappointment. What about us?
Hmm.
So when you do this sort of thing, you're opening up yourself to, you know, a lot of criticism. You really are.
Do you think it would have been better simply to set aside some time or some attention next November 11th for the Afghan people, the Afghan veterans and people who died in Afghanistan?
Their names could have been listed, like as the Royal Canadian Legion, as you know. We are in charge of the remembrance service here in Ottawa.
Yes.
And, of course, we could have had all of the 158 that paid the supreme sacrifice. We could have had all of their pictures put on the big screens that we've done for the last 2 years, and shown that solemn respect to them at that point in time. Mm. And I believe that that can still be done, but I think that why the government is doing this, I'm not sure. I just pray to God, John, that there's no politics involved in this.
Mm.
Everybody's saying that there is, but when it comes to our serving men and women, politics should be in the bottom drawer, and just show total respect to our veterans and their families.
That was Gordon Moore, the Royal Canadian Legion's president, speaking with Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Now, Moore had also complained about how the last Canadian flag flown in the mission was originally planned to be handed to the Prime Minister instead of the Governor General, who is Canada's Commander-in-Chief. The story was first posted on the Maclean's website and appears to have made an impact. At the last minute, the PM's office changed the program to make sure the flag was presented to the Governor General.
Coming up, we speak with Liberal MPs about Leader Justin Trudeau's new rules on the issue of abortion. We find out why anti-abortion activists are calling on Health Canada to ban a drug called RU486. And we speak with a former Justice Minister about the battle between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we take a look at the latest revelations in the war of words between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But first...
Thousands of people gathered on Parliament Hill for the annual anti-abortion demonstration called March for Life. Soon we'll talk more about the goal of the activists and a topless protest that interrupted the event. But we wanted to start out our coverage with a political debate within the Liberal Party over the issue.
On Wednesday, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau met with reporters after his party's caucus meeting, and that's when he made a surprise commitment.
Future candidates need to be completely understanding that they will be expected to vote pro-choice on any bills. The existing MPs who have been grandfathered in to a certain extent will be respected to a certain extent in their choices, but our position as a party is we do not reopen that debate.
It caught some anti-abortion Liberal MPs off guard. In a brief chat following question period that day, Toronto's John McKay shrugged off his leader's words, saying this doesn't change a thing for him. He's running again in 2015, and he's going to stick with his beliefs.
There's not a person in the riding doesn't know where I stand on a whole variety of issues. You know, you can run, but you can't hide in this business. And so, you know, stand up, tell people what you think. And my experience is that at the end of the day, that's what the people respect that more than they get bent out of shape about the issue itself.
But he won't say what he would do if a vote on the issue ever comes before the House of Commons again. Another Liberal MP who is against abortion is Kevin Lamoureux. I asked him about what he plans to do after Justin Trudeau's hard stance on the issue.
If this issue pops up in the House of Commons again, whether it be a motion or a private member's bill, how will you vote? Will you abstain from voting, maybe?
The danger of this is that, you know, obviously it makes me feel somewhat uncomfortable in the sense that I will never change my personal belief on the issue, and I'll be perfectly clear on that. Having said that, I am a parliamentarian first and foremost in representing my constituents, and I've got to take into consideration what party platform is and what the leaders' whip votes are, such as the budget and the charter, and then I've got to vote accordingly, unless, of course, I don't want to be a part of a party. The Liberal Party is the party of choice for me for a wide spectrum of different reasons. I do not want to be a one-issue member of Parliament and be defined by one issue.
But have you decided what you might do if an issue like this pops up again in the House of Commons? There's a chance that it could, and you may be forced with either abstaining from the vote, voting against your party, or doing what Justin Trudeau has called for and voting with the party in a whip vote.
As I say, I recognize that as long as it is a part of an election platform related to the charter or the budget that the Liberal caucus will in fact be voting in favor of. So I would be obligated to vote likewise.
You have the option to abstain, though. Would you take that option if it goes against your morals?
You know, at the end of the day, there's many priority issues that I take very personally. And if I were to apply that same principle on all the different issues, I might have a very sporadic voting history, and I don't think that's a service to myself. I'm not naive to believe that my personal opinion has to prevail on every single issue. I don't think that's fair to my constituents or my party. I believe I can best serve by being a good parliamentarian, get engaged in debates, allow my personal feelings to be shared, but don't rule by my personal feelings. And if this is a whip vote, I will vote with the party.
Have you spoken to Justin personally before or after his scrum on Wednesday? Did you know that he was going to say that on Wednesday?
I didn't know he was going to say that on Wednesday. I was not surprised once he said it.
Have you talked to him since?
I have seen him since then and have indicated that I'm okay with what it is that he's saying.
That was Liberal MP Kevin Lamoureux.
On Thursday, a crowd of anti-abortion activists made their way to the Hill for the annual March for Life, an event aimed at making abortions illegal in Canada. But the opening speeches were interrupted by a pair of topless protesters.
Money, my choice, my body, my choice.
They also shouted obscenities until the two had to be hauled away by RCMP officers.
The rally continued, and on the march through the streets of Ottawa, the crowd faced a large group of pro-choice protesters. Both sides then engaged in shouting matches, although it didn't escalate any further. Julie took part in the counter-demonstration, saying she is standing up for women's rights.
I think criminalizing abortion is absurd. Not only is it offensive, but it also will not stop abortion. What we know is that there's two things. There's legal abortion and there's unsafe abortion. Criminalizing abortion will not reduce the amount of abortions that happen in Canada.
And where does that lead to if it is criminalized?
Oh, if you take away access to abortion, you're taking away access to women's health care. And so moving forward, it's important for us to always resist any anti-choice attack on our rights and to really be present whenever these discussions are happening.
The whole goal of the march this year was to speak out against the drug RU486. It's a pill that can cause an abortion weeks after a woman finds out she's pregnant, and it's been under review by Health Canada since December 2012. The drug has been around since the late 80s when it was introduced in France. Since then, it's been approved in 57 countries, including the United States, the United Kingdom, and much of Western Europe. I sat down to speak with Joanne Brownrigg, who's in charge of government relations with the Campaign Life Coalition, the organizers of the March for Life.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
First off, we'll start with the theme of this year's March for Life, RU486, a drug that terminates pregnancies. Can you explain why you are opposed to this drug being approved in Canada by Health Canada?
Yes. Well, the theme was RU for Life in a response to RU486. This is a battle that took place early on in 2000. The advocates for this drug have brought it forward again. Our opposition to the drug is, frankly, it kills the unborn, but sometimes it kills the mother as well. The side effects are dreadful, from severe bleeding to septic shock, death. It is not a drug of choice. It is not an abortion method of choice. Clearly, we're opposed to all abortions. For us, there are no good abortions. But at one point, someone has to advocate for the well-being of women. And it's frankly left up to the pro-lifers to do that by exposing the side effects of this drug.
In your news conference on Wednesday, and just now, you say the drug is responsible for those deaths. But in the FDA website in the U.S., where the drug has already been approved and there have been 14 deaths of women in the U.S. after taking this drug, they do say flat out, the quote is, "We do not know whether using RU486 caused these deaths." I mean, you're saying that they caused the deaths, but even the FDA says we don't know that for sure.
Well, we are quoting Food and Drug Administration data from 2011 that points to the deaths. We're also looking at European studies that have also confirmed deaths. My response to that would simply be, if someone takes a drug and the drug leads to septic shock, do you say the person died of septic shock, or do you say that the person died from taking the drug which led to the septic shock? Abortion is a very politicized issue, and we want to keep it purely on a reasonable ground. This drug is a dangerous drug, and it's not just the FDA that is saying yes or no. There are studies around the world.
But any drug can cause adverse side effects. Just take a look at acetaminophen, Tylenol. It was responsible for 458 deaths due to acute liver failure over an 8-year period. RU486 over 11 years has had 1.5 million women in the U.S. using the drug. Only 14 women died. That means it has a death rate of 0.0009% for the use of the drug.
Yes. And, you know, you make a good point. I understand what you're saying. It's not bad enough that there are other drugs that would lead to more serious complications, and that may be the fact. What we are saying is those who are pushing this drug have a two-pronged approach. They're saying that this is an easier abortion method. Women who have undergone this abortion method, who have not died, have still spoken about the severe bleeding, the painful cramping, the hemorrhaging. The difference is they're doing it alone in their home. They're literally bleeding out in their home, alone in their bathroom. They're cleaning up the mess after the abortion. This is not an easy simple procedure like taking Tylenol for a headache.
What do you think is behind the delay in the decision by Health Canada?
My response to that is simply that because we have studies from other countries, because we have research that exposes the effects of this drug, to me, it may prove that we simply have a higher standard of care in Canada. So we're going to trust the scientists as far as their work, but no one is fooled by the fact that this is a purely scientific decision. We have a conservative government that said they did not want to reopen the abortion debate. Access to this drug increases access to abortion, and that's a very serious consideration.
Do you have proof that there is political interference in a decision that should be normally just left up to the scientists and doctors who are looking at all of this?
No.
Okay.
A one-word answer. As much as we would like to think that we could exercise that, there is the democratic process, I have to add, that if a drug is deemed to be dangerous, the health minister does have the authority, I understand, to put a stop to it, regardless of what Health Canada says. There is that purview. There is that power. We have had absolutely no indication that that is being exercised, as much as perhaps we would like to see it go our way.
Since we're discussing the political process at the moment, your coalition has come out and said that you have a strategy for trying to push out pro-choice MPs and replace them with people who have views of your own, anti-abortion viewed candidates. So why don't you tell me a little bit about this strategy? Why do this? And what steps have you taken so far out of this strategy?
Well, I am not going to talk about the specifics of the strategy. The nomination processes belong entirely to each individual party. They have their processes for nominating candidates. Because we live in a democracy, people can get involved in their nomination process. Hence, we have some one-issue candidates regarding the environment. We have our issue, which is anti-abortion, and we would prefer to see pro-abortion candidates pushed out. Our role is to put pro-life candidates in, and that's just as much our role and what we do. The specifics I'll leave to another time.
It's nomination time right now for, mm-hmm. for all parties.
Yes.
Have you been successful in this strategy so far?
Well, we've had some successes and some failures.
Can you say what ridings they are?
No.
Why not?
Because we recognize how political this issue is, and prudence and discretion are as valuable for our side as they are for the pro-abortion side.
But wouldn't, on either side of this debate, wouldn't someone be forward about their point of view on this?
And they are when they're speaking to the voters. They will be when they're speaking to the party itself and the candidates who have to vote them in. It's not something that necessarily has to be public yet at this time.
That's Joanne Brownrigg with the Campaign Life Coalition.
Still to come on the show, a former justice minister gives his thoughts on the latest revelations in the war of words between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And the McLean's panel weighs in on the battle.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Our McLean's panel is coming up with political editor Paul Wells. But before we get to that, there's been a stunning revelation in this ongoing battle between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Last week, we found out Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin called the Justice Minister in July of last year to let him know the government's choice for the Quebec seat on the top court, Marc Nandon, may not meet the eligibility requirements. She had also tried to call the Prime Minister, but Stephen Harper says he denied the call because it would have been inappropriate.
Now, despite the government's problems with that phone call, Global reports not long after the PMO asked Nandon to resign from the federal court and rejoin the Quebec bar just so he could be eligible.
To get his thoughts on this messy situation, I sat down with former Justice Minister and current Liberal MP, Erwin Cotler.
You know, concerns have obviously been raised about what happened last week with the Chief Justice and the Prime Minister. How are you at all satisfied that this is maybe passed, or is this still going, and how big of a concern should this be?
I would hope it would be passed, because I think we have to, for purposes of the country as a whole, We have to have a basic respect for the foundational institutions in this country, the institutions of government, the separation of powers, the Constitution. And I would not like to see any prejudice caused to the independence or integrity of the Supreme Court. I would not like to see judges themselves feel somewhat defensive because they're going to be called out by the Prime Minister. So we need to maintain, from a procedural point of view, a consultative process between the government and the courts with respect to the nomination of judges that remains confidential, that is genuinely consultative, where no party has to feel that there's going to be a breach of confidentiality, but where there is a respect for that consultative process. I recall when I was a Minister of Justice that we even published a protocol as to who we would consult, as to what were the criteria with regard to the professional criteria for a prospective appointment, personal criteria. And I would go back again after we drew up the first prospective list of candidates, etc. The thing here is that the Chief Justice gave her opinion as part of a consultative process in which she, in my view, properly characterized a concern with respect to eligibility for office. She did not speak to the merits of Justice Nadam, who was not yet not only not a nominee, he was not yet necessarily even a candidate. So I think this is something that was perfectly proper for her to do and say. Otherwise, why consult her?
What went wrong with the Nadam appointment? Was there a problem from the start? Was it that the sequence of events didn't play out, that the government wasn't, you know, didn't launch a court reference before it made it its appointment? Where exactly along this line does the whole thing kind of go off
the
rails?
Well, it seems clear from even the more recent revelations that the government understood that there was a problem with Justice Nadon's appointment, and then sought ways to perhaps circumvent the matter of eligibility by perhaps having him join the Quebec bar for a brief period or appoint him otherwise to a court for a brief period. But all that would simply have not so much brought the courts into disrepute, it would have brought the process into disrepute. So it would have been the better judgment, since the government already realized it, to have then had that confirmed by the views of the Chief Justice, to just withdrawn from that appointment. And there are outstanding people in the Quebec bench and bar who could have been appointed to the court, that would have, in fact, inured a legacy of distinction for the government for having appointed them, and for the court for having had them as members of the judiciary. It is also possible that if they were that concerned, and Peter McKay acknowledged back in August about the fact that the Supreme Court Act effectively might have precluded an appointment of somebody like Nadon, that it might, in his words, need updating, well then why not move to update it? Why not amend it then? Why not send a reference to the Supreme Court? There are all kinds of things that the government could have done to have preempted and avoided what then ensued.
How, moving forward from here, does the selection process itself have to be completely overhauled? Can the selection process that we had for Nadon and previous judges be used again, or has the whole sort of process been, I guess, either tainted or muddied so much that it just needs to be completely changed?
I think the process has to be one that is more open, transparent, inclusive, and representative. I'd like to think that that's what we tried to do when I was minister. As I said, what the minister does to begin with to ensure openness and transparency is that he or she publishes a protocol of the people that they're going to be consulting, of all the various criteria involved in that process, etc. Then, in accordance with that, the minister draws up a preliminary list of prospective candidates, let's say 5 to 8, and then submits that to an independent advisory selection group, which is not made up of only MPs, nor certainly not made up of a predominance of MPs from the governing party, but has, let's say, a nine-person advisory selection group with a representative from the Provincial Attorney General, from the Provincial Law Society, and the Canadian Bar Association, from the Canadian Judicial Conference, two eminent public persons, and the like, not unlike the kind of thing that we sought to put in place. And they enter into their own independent consultative process. And from that initial list of the minister, they then come up with a short list, which then goes back to the minister, who then re-engages in a consultative process and then comes up with a prospective nominee. I think, as I said, that kind of process is more open, transparent, representative, inclusive, and ultimately effective.
How, you know, people observing this, I guess, from afar may be having a hard time or could have a hard time sort of parsing what's going on here and what it how it matters. And I, you know, not to sort of confuse things even further, but there are obviously two issues. There's one of the issue between the Prime Minister's office and the Chief Justice and that, and then there's the issue of Mr. Nadeau's appointment. Is there something here that you think people need to focus in on, or that people need to understand that why this matters, why this has been such a drama, and why this is important?
Well, I think that if we look at the Supreme Court, it is a pillar of our constitutional democracy. What that Supreme Court does matters. Who sits on that Supreme Court as a pillar of our democracy matters. We need to appoint the best people to that court, and we certainly do not have to have a situation where we are involved in some imbroglio between the government and the court, which, as I say, in the end of the day, does not benefit the government, does not benefit the court, and does not benefit the public, and does not benefit the Constitution. So it's a matter really of mutual respect. And here, I think something that has been missing in all this as well is the government, and through the government, the Minister of Justice. And I've always seen that the minister has a responsibility to promote and protect the independence and the integrity of the Supreme Court. That is part of an effective dialogue between the institutions of governance. I think that also was missing, and I think that's an important ingredient going forward. There has to be that respect factor, and if it's not there, then you're going to go down the road of creating minefields.
That was former Justice Minister and current Liberal MP Erwin Koller.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Aaron Wary and Maclean's political editor Paul Wells. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
As you just heard the interview with Erwin Koller, the government has a bit of an issue after these revelations that have popped up about the fact that, you know, yes, they called Beverly McLaughlin's call to the Prime Minister's office inappropriate, but then we find out that they actually tried to follow through on her concerns and actually asked Justice Nadeau to step down and join the bar in Quebec again. What do you make of this new revelation, Aaron?
I think it's another just remarkable twist in this whole affair. It adds another layer of mess to it. It adds another part of this whole thing that needs to be explained or could be explained and that the government doesn't really want to explain. I think that's sort of been the problem this week. You know, they had these dramatic couple of days with this exchange of statements between themselves and the Chief Justice, and then they seemed to kind of get cold feet and maybe not really want to talk about it that much. But they still wanted to sort of make cryptic comments about how the Prime Minister needed to clarify something and, oh, this, you know, this didn't really start until she released a statement and so on and so forth. I don't know whether they have achieved anything here. I mean, maybe they have left some hint in the minds of the conservative base that, you know, the court is against them, or the court, there's a big conspiracy here and the court is against them. And you know, again, they're fighting the elites in Ottawa. But they aren't exactly projecting competence and grace and authority at this moment. They don't look like a government that's on top of things and that is, you know, keeping things running smoothly. And if that's supposed to be part of their brand, I kind of wonder where this is going.
So, Paul, this all started off when senior conservative sources had told a journalist on the Hill that Beverly McLaughlin was lobbying against Mark Nadeau, and then that was followed by the statement from the Prime Minister's office that called the call inappropriate. Has this whole thing sort of blown up in the conservatives' faces in that way?
I think that what we essentially saw was an expression of immense frustration with the Supreme Court in general on the part of this government. They've lost, by some counts, 5 high-profile cases at the Supreme Court level in the last several months, including the Senate reform reference and the Nadeau appointment itself. So I think this whole business about how McLaughlin was lobbying and how it was inappropriate, they compared it to a minister calling a judge, which is normally grounds for a minister to lose their job. I think this was an expression of frustration. To some extent, it's surprising that they're frustrated. It's increasingly clear that the government essentially tried their luck with Mark Nadeau and it didn't work out very well, but they knew they were trying their luck. That's why they put into the budget bill last fall what amounted to a constitutional amendment regarding federal court appointments from Quebec and the Supreme Court. That wouldn't have been necessary if it was cut and dried that Nadeau's appointment was okay. They got substantial advice from a range of sources, including apparently Chief Justice McLaughlin and others, that because of the peculiarities of the Quebec justice system, a federal court judge shouldn't be appointed to the court. And they did anyway. They did anyway because they thought that Nadeau had particular views and particular competencies that were very interesting to a conservative government on the court. And they got busted, and it didn't work out. They should dust off their clothes and move on and try something else somewhere else. But instead, they're kind of brooding over this. And then when they got caught brooding, when the PMO statement about Chief Justice McLaughlin got the Prime Minister in trouble with every law dean in the country, they have tried to kind of step back from that and to tone down the criticism and to essentially argue that they weren't in fact criticizing her. This is what you get when you let your emotions speak rather than your cold judgment of what's best for the government and for the country.
So, Aaron, where do we see this go from here? More conservatives trying to backtrack on this whole scandal? Or can they even really just tone this down any more further with the opposition jumping all over it now?
I think, oddly enough, they may escape from this now. I think today being a day where the House was off for the National Day of Honor, we now have a weekend for things to cool down, short of another revelation or more information that comes to light or some comment from someone, maybe this goes away and it just sort of gets left behind as an odd moment in the history of this government. It's which is odd. I think this is a potentially important thing that we've gone through this week, but they may get out of it. They may get away with it and not get away with it. I don't mean it in that sense, but they may get away from it. Especially if they can just name another Supreme Court justice. The other thing hanging over all of this is that the Supreme Court's been down a person for months now. If they can name another Supreme Court justice, then we all forget about Mark Nadeau and he sort of goes down as a trivia question.
In case you're just joining us, this is the McLean's panel. I'm Parliament Hill reporter Cormac McSweeney with City News and Rogers Radio, joined by my co-host Aaron Wherry and the McLean's political editor Paul Wells. We're going to switch topics here. Leading up to 2015, one of the narratives that the Conservative government has had, and it's always sort of had, is that they're the government of trade and the economy, and the opposition parties are anti-trade. And Paul, where do we see the government right now on a lot of these big trade files that they've been pushing for so long?
Well, this is just something I've been wanting to talk about for a while. And the occasion was presented this week when Carol de Gucht, the European Union's trade commissioner, the big trade guy over in Brussels, told Canadian reporters that there is still no Canada-Europe trade agreement, which is a funny thing because the day after the throne speech last autumn, Prime Minister Harper flew to Brussels for a big ceremony to announce the Canada-Europe trade agreement. That was, as they did say at the time, only an agreement in principle, and technical negotiations needed to continue. Well, 6 months later, they're continuing, and Commissioner de Gucht said they're not going that well, that there remain really substantial areas that need to be crunched. So 6 months after we announced the European trade deal, we don't have a trade deal. And it gets weirder. 18 months after the government gained the power to implement its foreign investment protection and promotion agreement with China, 18 months after the parliamentary review period ended and the government had complete power at any given day to implement a foreign investment agreement with China, they haven't done that. And nobody I talk to can understand why. Announcing this Investment Protection Act, which is supposed to protect Canadian investors who want to move into the booming Chinese economy, announcing the prospect of that agreement was the highlight of Harper's China trip in the beginning of 2012. And controversy about that agreement was the highlight of the autumn session of Parliament at the end of 2012. And a year and a half later, there actually is no agreement. So this government talks about free trade with Europe, but it doesn't have any. And it talks about opportunities for Canadian investors in China, and it hasn't improved those opportunities. It's a bit of a mystery, frankly, why that's so.
I think we can all see the communication strategy behind some of these announcements, announce them early on and then do another re-announcement halfway through or the next little milestone. And then when it's finally signed off, have a huge, huge media strategy around that. But as we approach 2015 in the next election, if these deals aren't signed, how much could this hurt the Conservative Party?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you're right to point out that we have to look at 2015. I don't know that we can necessarily say that none of this stuff is going to be done by 2015. That said, this has been an odd 6 months for this government. Five months, I guess. 2013 was supposed to be a bad year for the government. And the first part of 2014 has involved an odd fight over the Fair Elections Act, or at least an unnecessary fight, I think, over the Fair Elections Act. A really weird fight with the Supreme Court over Mark Nadeau. A major controversy over temporary foreign workers, all these things kind of piling up. If they can go into 2015, all that said, with a series of sort of economic pillars that they can point to and say, here are all the things we've done. This is why you need to reelect us. This is why we're the safe choice. Then they're still maybe in decent territory. But I wonder at some point whether they just sort of have exhausted their capital. I have... kind of this feeling that governments just eventually exhaust the electorate in this country. And, I wonder whether the Conservatives have maybe at all hastened that exhaustion over the last few months.
Paul, might they be able to get these trade and investment issues in order before the next election so that they can add some more tallies to their resume?
Sure. All it takes is for one side or the other to make concessions in a trade talk, and you can have a deal. The concessions themselves have some cost. The China one is interesting because there's a general sense, especially in British Columbia, which is a Pacific Rim society, that better relations with China are a good idea. But there are specific sectors where Chinese investment draws a lot of suspicion. And so... the downside of protecting Canadian investment in China is that you protect Chinese investment in Canada. A lot of nationalist left-wing groups made that point when this FIPPA was a big item in the news. And it's starting to look like the Prime Minister has paid those left-wing nationalist groups some attention. And while he probably doesn't agree with their analysis, he's a little spooked about proceeding in the face of those objections. So, I don't know. The election's a long way off, but in the meantime, we've got a country to govern, and there's this interesting gap between the announcements the government makes and the facts on the ground.
Thank you very much, my co-host Aaron Wary and Maclean's political editor Paul Wells.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.